Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show. It is episode number 163. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Mysteries.
Crime.
Suspense.
And thrillers. Welcome along to the show. Our guest this week is a returnee. It is Guy Hale.
Brave man.
He is a brave man. And he is a Worcestershire-based author who has been working with our side organisation, Arch Publishing Services, to bring out the first of his new series, which comes out next week, which is The Croaking Raven, which is set in Stratford-upon-Avon. And I'm about to start doing the audiobook for that.
Yes, as well. It's the hardback comes out next week, and I think the paperback and ebook are to follow shortly after.
Yeah, and the audiobook, who knows when? But I'm looking forward
soon.
To it. Well, yes, I'm looking forward to doing it. It's going to be a thrill. So it's a Shakespearean themed murder mystery.
Historic.
Yes, set in 1972. So looking forward to talking to Guy a little bit later in the show. As it, tradition dictates, we talk news at this stage of the show. And this is becoming a bit of a... okay, I'm going to forgive everybody for going switching off if
yeah,
I start
please,
talking about
please
Spotify.
Please don't go away.
But a couple of things have come to my attention this week. First of all, we've been talking about the contracts that Spotify have changed through Findaway Voices, which they bought 18 months ago. Findaway Voices is arguably the broadest of all the distribution channels that you could use, a one-stop shop initially when we started working with them, where you could distribute to all of the audiobook platforms you could possibly imagine, 42 of them. And that has been the case pretty much ever since. They lose the odd one when one shuts or whatever, another one picks up. But Spotify bought them and have moved into the audiobook market in a massive way. The controversy we've been talking about is the change of terms and conditions, which gave Findaway ancillary rights and rights to use your intellectual property in ways that were unimaginably awful and broad and despicable. Anyway, they've changed it slightly, but still the jury's out. And we've actually got to make a decision in the next week whether we're going to stay with Findaway. You can't actually cancel your productions with Findaway on their system anymore because they've taken away the delete button.
Why have we got a week?
Because that's when these new stipulations come into force.
Okay.
However, the sneaky
people
at Findaway have now put it in so that if you log into your dashboard, you accept the terms and conditions. By
logging in?
Yeah.
I log in every day.
Yeah.
Every other day.
So
I did it the other day.
We've effectively accepted because there was no choice. It's Hobson's choice. Absolutely disgraceful. But the other thing I was going to talk about, which is the latest development on Spotify, is two things. And their audiobook offer. They've just announced in the US a new audiobook Spotify subscription. Hitherto, if you were a Spotify premium subscriber, which is $12.99 a month, it gave you access to audiobooks, podcasts, and music without adverts, and 15 hours of audiobooks, as we've been talking about for the last few months, for free. And they're now introducing a subscription for audiobook listeners only, and it's only $2 cheaper than the premium everything you can eat Spotify offer.
Okay, that's still more than Audible.
Well, is it?
Well, $7.99 on Audible.
So, I think. Yeah, it's more expensive than Audible. Audible, you can only get one title a month, so you have to...
Oh yeah, that's true.
So you can have an audiobook that, and indeed I've got a couple which are 32 hours long.
Yeah.
Massive history books or fantasy or whatever it might be. But so why would people be attracted to paying just a little bit less and only get audiobooks for it for 15 hours? And then I think there's a small supplement you would pay to get another 10 hours worth of access to audiobooks on Spotify.
I have no idea.
Anyway, it's been met with some cynicism and derision by quite a number of publications in America asking, well, is that value for money? But the other thing I wanted to mention about the Spotify situation is, now, what I didn't know until today is that the creators of audiobooks only get paid if the whole of the audiobook is listened to.
Oh, so it's not like a page read equivalent?
No, it's not. It's not like for minutes listened.
So what if you get, I sometimes get to the end of the audiobook and I certainly don't bother with the, and this is a production by business.
Yes, I mean, I don't know whether that counts. imagine if it is and people just say, you know, the moment someone says the end, that's where you don't listen.
Yeah, that's what I do.
The person's denied the money. Again, another example of Spotify exploiting. Now, this is something that Guy Hale will talk about a lot because he works in the music industry, has his own record label, and that has been... his sort of, after he sold his business, that was his big focus, and now that exists alongside his writing. So he knows just how little money gets distributed by Spotify to musicians. He gives an example of one of his blues musicians, Mike Zito, getting 3 million listens, but only earning $2,000 from that. Can you imagine?
No, I was very shocked when he told us
that. Well, I'm not shocked because that's what Spotify do. But anyway.
No, well, you know what I mean.
But, I mean, if it is the case also so that you're not basically paying any creators because no one ever quite gets to the very end of the audio, I mean, it is yet another scandal. I mean, you know, what are we doing sitting here debating the decision? The trouble is, it's actually trying to get out of this contract, which is, you know... heinous. I don't think we'll ever distribute another book through Findaway Voices, that's for sure. But alternative arrangements are hard to find that are satisfactory.
I was
going to
say, you know, if we take everything out, that's all the royalties stopped until we make a decision on where to put them.
Yeah, but the alternative is this, is that if you were just, if we did it ourselves and we went into each individual retail platform, I'm not talking about the library subscription ones, and put our books on there, and uploaded them one by one to Apple and then to Audible. And then, you know, it's a very long-winded process. But that may be the thing we have to do and have fewer distribution points, but at least we're not being messed about in this fashion. Anyway, that's the Spotify update, which seems to be sort of a weekly occurrence.
We could have a Spotify podcast.
At this rate. No, we can't because Spotify probably won't run it. And we are, of course, this podcast is available on Spotify, just to make, you know.
Well, I mean, I have Spotify, so what does that make me?
Well, cancel it immediately.
But I listen to music in the car.
How very dare you? How very dare you? Anyway, my second story. Well, we've got a couple. One we're coming up in a minute, which was pointed out to us by one of our authors, Malcolm Hollingdrake, pointed this one out. And it's... a report in TechCrunch.
TechCrunch.
Let me go and...
Sounds like a very modern serial.
If not redirected here. This is where it all goes a bit wrong, so I'm going to... Right. And TechCrunch is one of those aggregators providing great, you know, sources of news on latest tech developments.
Yeah, so a bit like Publishers Weekly, but for IT things.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a new... publishing platform, or publisher, I should say, really, calling themselves a publishing platform, called Inkit. That's Inkit.
Just Inkit.
Why are you yawning so heavily?
Because I've been making cakes all day. I'm quite tired.
Well, explain why. Okay, all right. But that was very, very noticeable.
Sorry, I am tired.
Okay, all right. I was just taking offence.
Where are you taking it?
So Inkit are a self-publishing platform using AI to develop bestsellers, and they have attracted $37 million in investment to fulfill this ambition. So Inkit, a new startup, believes that it can use AI to turn the strongest of these into blockbusters. This is everyone's story in them, is what they can turn into, and to build a new Disney for the 21st century around that content. The startup's eponymous app lets people self-publish stories, and then using AI and data science, it selects what it believes are the most compelling of these to tweak and subsequently distribute and sell on a second app, Galatea. Its business has already attracted 33 million users and dozens of bestsellers, the company said. The new funding that it's raised, a Series C of funding, so the third round, will be used to expand the kind of content it produces. AI to write stories based on your original ideas and to produce versions of its fiction personalized for specific readers. A move into games and audiobooks and more video content adapted from fiction published on its platform. Video that is produced with humans today but will eventually also be generated just using AI. The longer-term vision, according to their CEO and founder, Ali Albazaz, sounds like a made-up name by AI, is to expand its content library and to build multimedia empire around it.
But don't you like the idea of reading a book that's been created specifically for you? It knows what you want out of a book.
Mm.
It's an interesting concept. I'm not at all agreeing with it. I'm just saying that is interesting, that element.
Yes.
And the same with video or whatever it is, whatever media it is. It knows what you want. Like, you know, yours would be something, some sort of mashup of darts and football.
Yeah, it's a bit redactive. Well, look, I mean, there's more detail here about what they're trying to achieve. So this is interesting. They're talking about building out chapters that are shorter and easier to read on mobile devices and incorporating a number of effects such as sounds throughout the text to make it the reading experience more dynamic. They are, you know, so they're using A/B testing like we would do with Facebook ads, for instance, to test what's most effective with readers. I mean, you know, someone was going to do this. It's up to people to decide whether they actually care. I mean, it's getting to this point where whether a human was involved in actually creating the content. To some extent, yes, the original idea might come from humans.
But
after that, it's all automated, is what's implied here. And do we really want that? Because the whole point of stories is one human telling a story to another human in whatever format it is, not something that has been, you know, synthesized by artificial intelligence.
Well, isn't this a lazy imagination? So we all have our imagination when we create stories in our own heads that are perfect for ourselves. But this is a lazy imagination. It does the imagination for you, creates a story for you.
We've been talking about on the show that the number of services and platforms and AI-generated tools, is the word I would use, to quicken up the writing and creative process by writers. And some are leaning into this massively and churning out books. Because ultimately, some people regard the book industry as just a product that you shove out there into the digital world and you just sell it like you would anything else that's on Amazon, for instance, and you spend your time building the marketing platform and using the tools to your advantage. And the more content you've got out there, the more you can sell, the cheaper you can make it, the better. And that is the approach of quite a lot of people. Quite a lot of people who are very noisy in the indie circuit are doing this sort of stuff or playing with it. I think it's really, really disturbing, personally.
It's disturbing, but it's the future. I mean, it's
a future. It doesn't have to be the future. The only thing that defines whether it's the future is whether users are prepared to pay money for this stuff.
Mm.
I'm not going to say crap because that's too easy to say. But this form of stuff created in this fashion, if people didn't use it and didn't subscribe to this sort of stuff, no one would be doing it. So it's up to, I think ultimately, it's a decision that consumers have to make.
But, I mean, if any technological advance has had this, hasn't it? It's people saying, you know, no, people aren't going to want to use the new factories. They aren't going to work in the factories. They aren't going to buy the goods, mass-produced goods. look at where we are now. So,
well, yes, but this is coming to, but this is another level, isn't it? I mean, you know, that's like saying, let's take the car industry, which had no robots in it 70 years ago, and now you would say, argue that probably 80% of the building process and design process of cars is either through computer technology or robot technology, right? And we don't complain about that, and yet loads and loads of people who would have hitherto been banging out the panels and assembling the cars are no longer doing it. But this is slightly different, I think. I think you can't continue to apply, ooh, technology, bad thingy argument, you know, the Luddites would have done all the, you know, it's not about that. It's about, this is a different thing altogether. Do we want to devalue the human input on intellectual creativity to the point where it becomes a machine automated process?
But if the machine does better than the human?
In what way better? Well, what define better?
That consumers prefer the machine created.
Well, that's a decision they have to make, but think of the consequences. That's all I'm saying.
No, I see. We argue about this often, and it's not necessarily that I don't completely disagree with you. I do agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I do think that AI is advancing so fast that it will get to a tipping point and go way beyond the tipping point when it does a better job than the person at writing a really good story.
Mm. Okay, well, the battle goes on, and we'll continue to debate that. Let's get into our interview, shall we?
I think we should.
Right, well, Guy Hell joins us again. As I say, Guy is a client of ours through ArchPub Services, which is terrific. But his new series, he's lent very heavily into the world of Shakespeare. His latest book, The Croaking Raven, is a murder mystery set in Stratford-upon-Avon, the home of the Royal Shakespeare Company, of course. And the
Bunch of Swans.
Yes. And it is 1972, and a former rising star of the theatre returns to Stratford, having had his career ruined by a number of figures, and he wants revenge.
Ooh.
That is the setting. And in this interview, Guy will go through, you know, a lot of the process and the thinking behind this latest series, but also for the authors listening to this and people interested in the publishing industry, he's taking a route direct to customers, which he's pushing very hard on and wants to be at the vanguard of that change. And indeed, he's been using some innovative approaches to getting his books into bookshops. So there's loads of things here. And dare I say it, we talk about Spotify as well.
We do a little bit, yeah.
So let's talk to Guy Hale. You know, Rebecca, it feels like I should be giving this a grand soliloquy.
What, a quee?
A soliloquy.
Yeah, I know what it is. Go on, then.
A grand introduction to our next guest.
Tom Baker?
No.
Oh.
You know, almost there. But we're talking to, for the second time, Guy Hill. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to see you both.
Welcome back.
Yes, a return visit. I must have behaved well enough last time.
Oh, you certainly did. And the reason I say soliloquy is because we're going to be dipping deep into the world of Shakespeare and Stratford-upon-Avon in this interview, because your new series is imminent and it is set in Stratford-upon-Avon. Murders inspired by Shakespeare plays is how I would describe the Croaking Raven. Is that a fair description?
I think that's a very fair description, yes. If you read it, any of the Shakespeare plays, there's a lot of blood and guts and sex, and it's all there if you want to read it, and it's quite dark, and it's quite funny, so it suits my style of writing perfectly. So,
is that how you would describe your writing? I mean, it is macabre and yet darkly funny.
Yeah, I always try and find the funny in the serial killing. You know, it's always, there's always a funny point somewhere. And I think if you're going to go dark, you've got to try and alleviate the darks. And I do that with humour. It's just, I tend to live my life like that. I don't kill people, obviously, but I always try and look.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. well, not that I'm going to confess to on air anyway, but yeah, I always try and look for the funny side in whatever situation. I just look for the funny side. I've got to tell you a quick story. I've got time for a quick story.
Yeah.
Very funny stuff. Minnie Driver, you're familiar with her?
Yes, the actress, yep.
Wonderful. Oh, I thought you meant the person who drives the Mini, no?
No, no, no. Not Minnie Driver, the actress. She wrote a brilliant book, an autobiographical book. And one of the stories is her father, when he died, he wanted to be buried in a woodland grave. So he had a wicker basket coffin. And she said, I'm sitting in the front row of the chapel with my son, full chapel. And in comes the undertakers with my father's body in this woven coffin, puts it down in front of a little lad who's about 11. He nudges her in the ribs, says, I didn't know there was a picnic, Ma.
Oh, brilliant.
I mean, you couldn't write that, could you?
No.
But do you think it's the British way, though, to find funny in the dark?
I think if you go back to through the annals of history, we have always had the ability to find a little bit of humour in even the darkest situations, in the trenches, during the Blitz. We've just got that ability. If you take a Brit and put their back up against the wall, that's when you find the best bit about us, because we are those kind of people. Well, I'm not having that. We're not going to be pushed around. We're very, very civil and terribly, terribly nice. But you push us too far and we're the wrong people. We won't have it, and we will do anything it takes. I mean, I'm convinced if Hitler had invaded, we'd have fought him to the last man, woman, and child. But I really do. I don't think we'd have capitulated the way some of the nations do, because it's our nature. We don't like being told what to do in this country, do we?
No, we don't. I think we have a rebellious spirit. So not like an obvious rebellious spirit, as in we don't have revolutions, but our sort of little individual, like,
Yes, come to Great Britain, home of the perpetual teenager.
Yes. I think the tourist board should use that.
Yeah, there is an element of that. And it's funny because it ties into it. I mean, the audiobook project I worked on last week is set in 1300, and it's from the perspective of King Edward's archer. So we're talking about Edward Longshanks. Everyone will remember him, I'm sure.
Built all the castles in Wales.
Not a cut of beef.
No.
He died in 1301, was it? He died.
Yeah, 1301, 1302, something like that. Yeah.
He built all the castles around North Wales, didn't he? Yeah.
That's right. So he built all the castles around North Wales and hemmed in, Wales. And it was he who was in conflict with William Wallace. So if you think of Patrick McGowan in Braveheart, that's the character we're talking about.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, who has ever managed to really subjugate? You might capture most of England, but you're going to really struggle to get Scotland and Wales. So there's always going to be a rump somewhere kicking off.
Yeah.
You're calling Wales a rump.
Yeah, okay. Fairly controversial.
Yeah. I do have a lot of Welsh friends, and they always say, the English are coming here, they take what our country are. And I said, hang on a second. That was the French that did that. It was the March of Lords that came into Wales. They'd already subjugated the English in 1066. And then it was further March of Lords coming in that then gradually did land grabs through Wales. And they occupied, I mean, he spoke French most of the time, Longshanks.
That's true.
So, it's harsh to blame. You can blame the English for a lot of things in Wales. But I don't think you can blame us for the occupation of the castles, because that was the French, the Normans.
I think you'd be really good at University Challenge. You know a lot.
Do you think? My son, probably. But I finished school after O-levels, because I became a professional golfer.
But do you think are you a sponge for knowledge, though? Because you're coming out with all this stuff.
I'm a sponge for things I'm interested in, and I don't absorb anything I'm not interested in. So you ask me about trigonometry and I'll just be a blank look on my face. I think if you take an interest in things, you absorb knowledge, don't you?
But that must help with researching, though, because you're obviously passionate about whatever book you're writing, so you can absorb all the knowledge and then it can all come out in your writing.
Yeah, well, there's two things, isn't there, with that? I mean, you write fiction so you can make it up. Which is great with the Jimmy Wayne. There was a bit of research in there, but that came from a knowledge of the music industry in the States. With the Shakespeare, we live near Stratford. We're there all the time. I love Shakespeare. So you had to get certain things right, but obviously the I thought the clever part was weaving it around the plot of Hamlet, or weaving Hamlet into mine. But it made the plotting of The Croaking Raven more difficult, because I had to weave a Shakespeare plot into my plot. But I think it worked all right. The reviews said it did.
Well, in a sense, so you create, I mean, at its core, for people who, I mean, most of us will know something of the plot of Hamlet, but basically we're talking about a young man who finds that his mother has cuckolded his late father. Turns out that, you know, basically that her new husband, his uncle, has ruined everyone's life. And that is the motivation for his revenge plot. And in this case, we're talking about an actor who's not been seen in the UK for 15 years, was a rising star, but had his career destroyed by, so the equivalence is Sir Maurice Oxford, Britain's leading actor of the period,
leading
about 1971, is basically Claudius. His mother, in the play it's Gertrude, but his mother's married Sir Maurice Oxford, as it does in Hamlet, and Oliver Lawrence is triggered by information that reveals that his career was trashed at the orders of Sir Maurice Oxford, and therefore everybody involved in that conspiracy has to die, as it does in Hamlet. So is that, I think I'm trying to do it in a nutshell, but I think without giving too much away.
I think you've nailed it quite nicely. But being lazy, there's a lot of people to kill, so I'm stretching it over three novels.
Yes.
He kills all his leading ladies in the second book, or the leading ladies he had a beef with in the second book, which is based around Othello and will be called Put Out the Light. And then he finishes the job off in the third book, which is based around Macbeth, where everybody dies, as you know.
Right. But, you know, we've also got a touch of King Lear in there. One of the first victims ends up a bit, well, like Gloucester, who has his eyes put out, and then a bit besides is without giving
plus stuff plus yes
yeah an extra bonus. We have an Ophelia character as well, somebody who goes and drowns themselves, so there's a heck of a lot going on there. So you say it was complex. I mean, clearly, in a way, if it was a traditional modern procedural, we've got police characters trying to catch up with our main murderer here. We know who's murdering because we see it from his perspective the whole way through. It would be slightly different, I think, in the way that, you know, you would approach the way those murders are committed. But you've stuck very, very closely, I think, to the way that Shakespeare would have done it.
Yeah, well, I started with a Polonius character. And so then once I'd started with Polonius, obviously Ophelia, his daughter's going to get it as well. She's not going off to any nunnery in my book. And so I tried to work it in where possible. To complement the story. Obviously, he's a killer, and he's got the advantage of it's 1972. He's been disappeared in Morocco for 15 years. He's come back. There are no automated electronics in the passports. There's no internet. So it's very hard to track people's movements. He's aged 15 years. He's put on a couple of stone of muscle because he's been laboring. And he comes back, and he doesn't look the same. Nobody recognizes him. And he's able to move around. There's no CCTV. There's no mobile phones. There's no PACE. The PACE didn't come into the Police Act until 1984. So so much harder to track people. So Akira had a much better time of it in the 70s and the 60s than they have these days. It's far too tricky these days.
Yeah.
So it allowed you to be a bit more creative then.
Oh, absolutely. I deliberately set it in 72 to not have mobile phones, to not have the internet, to have ease of movement, to make it hard to trace people so that he could walk around virtually under the noses of the local police and not be seen. So,
and in terms of those local police characters, I mean, we're talking at a period where sort of contemporary TV shows would be things like The Sweeney. And you've got Fred Williams, who is a detective sergeant who does everything that a modern policeman would be pulled up for.
That's
he's the longest serving detective sergeant in the country.
Yes.
Because he's done so many things that they could have imprisoned him for, but they keep on giving him medals for bravery. and his clear up rates are fantastic. So they just he's hit a glass ceiling that he's created himself. He believes in the good old days of kicking a suspect downstairs and back up them as well. lots of soap to slip on in the showers and beating a confession out of people when required. It's the old school, basically.
Yes. And if he wants to take some sausages as evidence after
that's his dinner.
After a break into a butcher's, then you know that's an important thing to do. But his counterfoil is his new partner. He's never worked with anybody else that closely, and it's Toby Marlowe, who comes from Birmingham, who's become a detective constable. So it's a promotion. Yeah. You know, it's what he wanted to do. He's desperate to work in Stratford, and he comes up against you know, Warwickshire's biggest dinosaur. It's
a dynamic, interesting dynamic.
I think Toby's big problem is that he's encumbered by integrity, which is always a problem, isn't it? If you're working with somebody that likes to get the job done, like Fred, but they get a grudging respect for each other, and he becomes like the son that Fred never wanted, and indeed never had. Now, I just think that they bounce off each other very well. I just think they learn from each other.
Yes.
Whether Fred actually absorbs any of the stuff, but I think basically at heart, Fred is a good man and he just wants to put villains away.
Yeah. Mm.
And he doesn't care too much how he does it. He'll cut any corner that needs to be cut. He's quite happy to do that. Mm. Whereas Toby, at the start of what he hopes will be a long, successful career, and he's quite idealistic, he's tending to dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
Mm.
He's basically a millennial in 1970s clothes.
No, I just... learn about themselves through the other person in a way.
Yes, they're holding up a mirror to each other's soul.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a fair point. But if I were to pick out one character who's my favourite, and then we also explain to people that at some point, very near future, I'm going to be committing, well, I'm committing crime, no, but I'm going to be committing my voice to this as an audiobook, is Wampa. Now, Wampa is the extraordinary biker-clad deep throat in the roughest pub in Stratford who always seems to be one step ahead of what's happening.
Yeah.
And they can't figure out why until the end. And if we just sort of hint at some Macbeth connections, then you'll perhaps people will understand why. But he's brilliant. What a character.
Yeah, I love Wampa. He's based on a friend of mine. Pete Smith, and I just thought, Wampa, I want this kind of oracle figure who is sitting there and he's all seeing, and I wanted him to be the third one of twins. And his two sisters, whenever they appear, they go into speaking as a Greek chorus.
Yeah, the sort of in tongues kind of approach, in a trance.
I'm actually writing the second novel at the moment, and there are some clues being laid down, unexploded bombs, as I like to call them, for the final novel, whereby basically they are the three witches, one of which is Wampa. But Wampa has an encyclopedic knowledge of everything, even stuff that hasn't even happened yet. And I think that's important in life, Dad.
Well, that's quite witchy, isn't it? So
yes, he's got unexplained depths. I think that's the way I put it. I'm glad you like
it. And before we move off the subject of Croaking Raven, I mean, you know, what I love, another aspect is that having done some research just recently going to Stratford, it looks fantastic. What a cover. it is beautiful.
I can't wait to see it in the flesh.
Yeah. the way that you've really gone under the skin of the place, and particularly the Dirty Duck.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
I want to go there.
Which was the Black Swan pub, which is right opposite the main theatre of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously Green King have got hold of it and gentrified it a bit. But it's a pub that was called the Dirty Duck by the GIs and the airmen nearby. Because, you know, they didn't want to call it a Black Swan, so they went for Dirty Duck.
But, again...
Those hostelries that you feature are like the epicenter of all good, like a good 70s cop show would be, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Garrick features a lot more. I don't know if you've been in the Garrick, but that's a proper old pub.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a brilliant place. I think it's some parts of it about 1400 and something. I mean, it's a beautiful old place. But it's a proper drinking pub. You know, there's very few airs and graces in the Garrick. And that's as it should be. You know, it's not touched by tourism, I'd like to say, but it's a really good old-fashioned pub. So there's so much history in Stratford. If you just scrape under the veneer a little bit, it's all there still.
Yeah, and as a setting, I mean, it has such a broad appeal because even when I was there with my friend Russell, the BBC's tennis correspondent, we were having a drink together and had lunch. We're walking. We came out of the Royal Shakespeare Company Theatre, and at that point, two people carriers, very very posh people carriers, rolled up, and a whole bunch of, I didn't know what nationality were, East Asian television makers jumped out with cameras. With the full rigs, and they were doing a very plush sort of travel show outside in Stratford. I mean, the international appeal, I think people in this country don't really appreciate just how it is one of the five pillars of British
It
tourism.
is, yeah,
Yeah,
definitely. Second to London,
if
isn't
you
it?
come out of the theatre, say if you come out of the Swan,
Yeah.
turn left off Waterside, down Southern Lane, go to the end there, go up Old Town, and then come back down Church Road and Sheep Street. You'll probably meet half the nations of the world during the course of
Yes.
any one walk. It's incredible. And I love this time of year as a local. It's a lot quieter. But I love it in the summer, just hearing so many different tongues spoken. You think people are coming here because of a writer. I mean, a guy who wrote some amazing plays 450 years ago, and they're coming from all over the world because of a written word on a page. Isn't that wonderful? That's the power of the written word. It's just amazing. And if you read Shakespeare, I mean, a lot of people can't get past the iambic pentameter. But if you treat it as poetry and get into the rhythm of it, it's really easy to understand.
Yeah, no, I
And
agree.
what that man didn't understand about the human condition, not worth knowing. I
I always
mean,
recommend
incredible.
people to watch Shakespeare because
Yeah.
that's what it was supposed to be anyway. And so,
Go to
you know,
the
when people say,
theatre.
oh, I can't get into it, I don't understand it, I said, just go and watch,
Well, we
just
were there last
absorb it.
night watching Ben and Imo about Benjamin Britten with Imogen Hulse when they were doing the Britannia Symphony for 1973 for Queen Elizabeth's inauguration. And that was an amazing piece of work. But we're there next week for Midsummer Night's Dream with Matthew Bainton. And it's beautiful new interpretation, very, very funny. And that'll bring people in from all over the world to watch that. You'll sit in that
Who's he
audience.
playing in that then? Is he Bottom
I think
or?
he's playing, Bottom or Puck.
Yeah.
I haven't read the programme. So
Yeah, and he's
we've
from
got
Horrible
tickets.
Histories or Ghosts.
Oh,
He's the one.
is he? Who is he in Ghosts? Which one? The tall bloke.
Thin faced,
Oh, yeah, I know.
youngish.
Oh,
He's in the role.
he's the French, not
Yes.
French, but kind of dandy guy
Yeah.
who falls in love with
Remember,
everything.
he was in The Wrong Man's as well.
Yes, The Wrong Man's
Yeah.
with James Corden. Yeah.
Yeah, that was very good as well. Yeah,
Yeah,
very
he was
good.
brilliant in that.
I did
Yeah.
love Ghosts.
And
Yeah,
I
Ghosts
keep
too.
thinking to myself, it's really not, it's not far off our doorstep, so we ought to go a bit more.
Well,
But
Stratford.
yeah.
Well, I
But
would imagine, Adrian, after you've voiced these books, you'll be
yes.
rewarded. Just to let you know, a bit of information, the RSC will be stocking this book.
Oh, good.
Is that right?
Oh, yes, darling. Confirmation today.
Well, I think that's fantastic because I was looking at the books and thinking that's exactly what they need to
Yeah.
balance up all the. I mean, I bought a
Books are
couple of
companion
books
to
on
Shakespeare, which I know they do.
acting, my love, and then of course there's Judi Dench's book on Shakespeare, very prominent,
And of
and so forth.
course, Dame Susie Tench does appear in
Yes,
the book. She's not
Susie
a dame at
Tench,
this stage, there. She
Theo
must.
Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
There's a few, and then then I couldn't help noticing that one of the coppers is Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
Now, is that a wrestling reference or what?
To be fair, I actually knew a copper from Warwickshire called Dusty Rhodes.
Really?
So I just stuck him in.
Ah, okay.
Ah,
So that was I thinking it was
you're
the
overthinking
American Dream,
it then.
Dusty Rhodes.
No, I'm afraid that was somebody I knew. There are like the Dick Meyrick, the rugby playing landlord at the Dirty
Yes.
Jack, is actually Richard Meyrick. a rugby playing friend of mine from. I just thought, well, I'll write him in as the lamb. I do that with my friends. They won't. They wind up in my books. Sometimes I change the names and sometimes I don't. And I quite often end up doing the thing they hate most to them in the book as well. So, you know.
Perfect. Perfect. Mm. Well, look, that's very exciting news because I was going to say, you know, it is the perfect thing and the cover is so good. It needs to be seen in the RSC book.
I want to feel the blood.
Let's talk about.
I have two copies of the hardback for you both. So.
Oh,
thank you.
No, that's lovely.
No, I mean, Guy, with your business background, you're very keen, I know, to explore ways to get independent book sales, you know, at a level which actually sustain, you know, the effort, really.
Yeah.
As indeed we do. But you're very keen to be at the sort of vanguard of direct sales.
Yeah.
Which is really the buzzword, I think, in the indie community at the moment. Because, let's be honest, we're all pretty disillusioned with the Amazon model. It seems to be set up for them to make money and no one else to a very considerable degree. You know, the margins are getting so tight, especially if you're making physical copies, which you've described. You know, you've got your hardback and your paperbacks. And
dealing with Amazon is always a headache as well.
So,
all those things.
Yeah.
What's your reading on it? Because, I mean, certain people are making a very dramatic move towards things like Book Vault, so that, you know, it's basically essentially drop shipping for books rather than relying purely on one outlet in Amazon.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can ever rely on Amazon because Amazon are very, very clever with the way they hide who the people buying your books are from you. So you don't know who your market is. You can't find out who's been buying your book because they're very clever at that. And they then get even cleverer by continually tweaking the algorithm. So your advertising is constantly having to change to have any effect. Because they're protecting their own interests, they don't want to help you. They just want to help themselves. And I suppose that is the first rule of business. Protect your business by making sure nobody else can go around you. So I think you've got to be on there because the Amazon reviews count. But I am trying to work more with independent bookshops and have my own website, retail for my own website. I mean, to give you an example, I printed 350 copies of the hardback and over half of them are pre-ordered. Pre-orders don't close it. So, you know, that's all direct profit straight into my bank account from my website. The only thing you own online, you don't own your Twitter, your Facebook, any of that stuff, your Instagram, any of that could change tomorrow. You could lose it all. You only own your website. That's the only space online you have. So you need to attract as many people as you can to your website. That's yours. You own that. Everything you do with that, you can make it positive. I've got like 2,000 subscribers now. I didn't start that long ago. So every time I offer something, there's 2,000 people actively looking at that. So you can get quite a good conversion rate. And the thing is to keep on offering them deals and try and, you know, I write a book every 6 months. I may get to the stage where if I've got a couple of friends who need a bit of help, I might put their books out as well. But I keep it very, very tight. It's very hard to promote something through Amazon because Gardeners, God bless them, you can't deal with the independent bookshops without going through Gardeners because most of them use Gardeners as their repository, for their cash flow, even though I'm quite happy to offer certain bookshops terms and conditions. Most of them will want to just marry up orders for multiple books from Gardeners.
Yes.
But Amazon, as Rebecca pointed out, to me the other day, much to my chagrin, it's very hard to get a direct account with Amazon in the book world unless you're one of the massive publishers. So you want to sell a book. So there's the book. You've manufactured it. Then you've got to ship it to Gardeners. They'll put their markup on. Then they ship it to Amazon. They'll put their huge markup on. And then they ship it out. So it's very, very hard to make money through that route. All you're doing is maintaining your position there, so people can see you. You're actually visible in the book market. But if you want to actually make a living and a career at it, you have to find a way to get direct to your customer and find out who your customers are. Yeah. Now, I don't know how many authors actually want to do that because it's really hard work. Your traditional deal, your average traditional deal, you'll be lucky if you make 80p a book, even if it's going through the booksellers. So you've got to sell a lot of books to make a living. And that's why a lot of people, well, most authors I know, have a second job. Because you have to. Artistic people in this country are not well served because we don't have the net book deal, do we?
No.
Every other country, I think, in Europe and America, have the net book. We don't net book agreement. We don't do it here. So you can discount books. So the people that actually write the bloody things and the independent publishers like you are the people getting squeezed. Without us, there is no book world. And we're the people that are getting beaten about the head.
Yes.
Yeah. So it begs the question, why are we, what are we doing?
Well, I mean, yeah, no,
there is to do it, haven't you?
But I think you raise a very good point about the net book agreement, which was ripped up in the late 80s, early 90s. And paved the way for W.H. Smith, the supermarket discounting, and for Waterstones in particular, to take a grip on the rate that people pay, and you know, it's near impossible with a hardback to get full price for it, because you know that Waterstones will buy a whole load of them, get the author to sign 12,000 copies and break their wrist, and they'll also shove some exclusive content in at some point in the thing, and then they'll say, you know, and they'll charge 10 quid for it or 12.50 or something, half price. It's extraordinarily difficult in that marketplace for us to compete. But I think it's, I mean, we're very interested to see how you progress. And one of the things that, you know, you and Rebecca were discussing, I think, over email last week was, is it possible to become a direct seller into Amazon without the distribution through Gardeners? And I think it is. I did some digging.
We listened to a podcast today as well. So there's this hope.
Well, I have to say to everybody listening, without Rebecca's help, I wouldn't have got to where I got to. She has been fantastic. What Rebecca doesn't know about this game isn't worth knowing. And she's so quick, you know, apart from with her invoices. She's a bit slow sending me
invoices. I know. I need to do you one, don't I? Yeah. I usually do my invoices at the end of the month, so we are at the end of the month, so it'll be coming soon.
I've got loads more work planned for you, Rebecca. So.
Excellent. Keep you busy.
I was going to say that I think there is a growing movement for people not to use Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP, as their dashboard and platform for physical copy.
Yeah, so because I know other people who are going away from it.
You know, you go to, you become an Amazon seller, get an Amazon seller account, Seller Central, and you do that instead. And that actually gives you a heck of a lot more data from your sales.
It does.
You know, and this is the one of the things that is so punishing. I mean, you're talking about in KDP terms, our standard book price for an ebook is $2.99, of which we're giving away a quid of it to Amazon. That's quite apart from the cost of actually marketing it if you use Amazon ads as well.
Yeah.
And they don't give you any really robust or usable data to figure out, as you were saying, it's all behind their smoke screen. Well, you know, they're holding that data. Whereas with Amazon Central, they do give you the opportunity, just a little bit more insight, which has created a whole ecosystem of platforms which will allow you to automate your sales and your marketing in a way that KDP doesn't allow you to do. So it makes sense, especially if you're going to the expense and the trouble of creating hardbacks, you know, a premium product with a bigger margin on it.
Yeah.
It is worth doing and not going the Gardener's route. And but the other thing that comes with Amazon, of course, with physical copies, and I'm sorry if I'm sort of interrupting here, but
people listening will be very interested in
this. I think what people don't seem to realize is that increasingly Amazon is making it extremely hard for those books that are sourced through Gardeners to arrive at through your letterbox any quicker than a month's time.
So we've noticed this. If we publish a book as Amazon print on demand, it'll say next day delivery, whatever, Prime, blah, blah, blah. The ones we publish with Clay's or with Ingram Spark will say 3 weeks And there's no reason for it to be 3 weeks. Because it's not 3 weeks.
It's because they want you to do everything through their printing system.
They're punishing us for not using them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a monopoly, basically. That's what it is. That's what they're attempting to do. And I'm afraid the governments around Europe are allowing them to get away with it. I mean, I'm a businessman, but you can't let companies come into your country, sell billions of pounds worth of stock, assorted stuff to assorted English, Welsh, Northern Irish, Scottish people, and not pay a proper tax on that. We need to just say, no. Anything that's sold in this country is subject to the tax of this country. And if you don't like it, on your way. Because they won't go.
No.
Because they can't afford to go. And if they did go, well, somebody else would slip in and fill that void. That's the nature of business. We've got to be really careful because we want to do all these things with the health service and roads and education. But if you don't pay tax, and most of us working people, we pay our taxes. Some of these big corporations, your Costa Coffees and whoever, you know, they are quite slippery with the way they do their accounting, you know. So you've got to be very careful that you do encourage commerciality, but make sure it pays its taxes.
Yeah.
Mm.
On that subject of big tech then, I mean, we were discussing just before we started recording, and we've talked about this before when we spoke to you about your relationship with big tech in the music industry, because you have your record label and some fabulous artists who are making a pittance because Spotify, who are now muscling in an extraordinary way in the audiobook market, but they have destroyed the music ecosystem to a very large degree, unless you can make money from live performance.
Yeah.
But they're doing the same to us in publishing through audiobooks because, you know, they've just basically taken over Findaway Voices, which was when I first signed up our books to it, was a really good thing.
Yeah. It was a good thing for a company like us, wasn't it?
Cracking company, Findaway Voices, absolutely cracking company. You can't blame the directors there. They built a nice company. They got a load of money to sell it. But my heart sank when I saw Spotify were buying it because, I know what's going to happen here because I'm in the music industry. And lo and behold, within a few weeks, it was happening. New contracts came out and they were just slavery contracts, basically, to make you poor and tie you into them. And I sent an email to Vaseem Khan at the CWA. I said, Vash, you need to get people to read these contracts because they're pernicious in the extreme and they're daylight robbery and they will ruin the audiobook market. Audible are finding it now because they're giving, is it 15 hours of free?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, who's providing the free audio? Yeah, the people like you and I, we're providing the free audio, not them. So it's a joke. But they don't make money. I mean, I keep on saying this to young people. I said, Spotify, do you like that artist? Yes, I love them. Well, if you love them, why aren't you buying their record, even if it's downloading from Apple, because they make more money?
Yeah.
God's sake, I don't like Apple, but, you know, at least you get more money as an artist. Your artist is being ripped off. He's being mugged by these companies. It's nothing short of being mugged for his intellectual rights.
Yes.
And you're thinking that's okay. You need to think about what you're doing with your purchases because creative people are getting crucified by the modern internet age. Downloads are killing and it will kill everything. The film industry will one day get killed by streaming if we're not careful. These huge back catalogue. I wonder from the music side, at the moment, the big three record companies have sold out all their artists because they've got these huge back catalogues of music they stole on contracts which were disgusting.
In the 70s and
60s. Yeah, and left all these people, and the 80s and the 90s, left these people bereft of all their intellectual rights. And now they're recycling that and taking profits off that. They're giving it away cheap, but they've got masses of it to give away, and they're paying nothing out hardly on it. So they can afford to do that. But a lot of young artists now, when I talk to a young artist and we say, we do a deal where we don't take your intellectual rights, you keep the copyright. We only make profits, 50% of the profit on what we actually manage to sell for you. Really? You mean I still own those songs? Yes, you are. I only own those songs on the record that we've made with you. You still own the rights to those songs and they're played on the radio. Do I? Yeah, because they've just been shafted for years. And I think there's not many people do what we do, mainly because you don't make much money out of it. It's more
No.
of a realistic thing. But a lot of them are now starting to make their, I think this is going to happen in books. I think I'm a cottage industry. I think you're a cottage industry. And I think a lot of the writers and the creatives are going to say, well, actually, you know, I need to be in a cottage industry now. I need to find my public and I need to work to them and find my independent bookshops that want to work with independent authors as well as published authors and work with them and take away the people who are just there leeching off the creativity of others. Because that's the way big commerce and that they come in and they leech on creatives. And it's depressing, but creatives are there to be leached on. So we've got to try and make sure we don't allow that to happen.
And
So,
it's we don't value ourselves well enough, though,
yeah.
I don't think.
I mean, I'm lucky, I suppose. I don't, I'm retired, I've sold my business, and I do this because I love it. But if I'm going to do something, I thought, oh, I'm going to make money out of it. I'm not doing it for nothing. I'm not going to spend thousands of pounds trying to put books out. So I've got to see a way of making it pay. I found a way to make it pay, I think. And it's working quite well. But that is predicated on working with independents, a little bit of Amazon, and direct selling at book festivals and through my website. You've got to find your tribe.
Yeah.
Yes,
And
indeed.
in terms of that, just before we go to the infamous random question
Question.
for a second time, in terms of going to independent bookshops, because we get mixed report backs, because quite a number of our authors will approach independent bookshops, and some are lovely and take the books, and that's great. But others say, oh, God, not another bloody author or publisher or whatever, and show them the door. I mean, what's your experience of approaching? Because clearly, the RSC are taking it, but you've had other successes as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I went out there, I would take them a set of the Jimmy Wayne books and I'd walk through the door, I'd introduce myself and I'd say, I'd normally send an email first, so I wasn't walking in cold, but I've done it cold plenty of times. So listen, I'm an independent writer. There's my books. As you can see, they're top quality, good reviews, blah, blah, blah. I don't expect you to take a chance on me. I'll take a chance on you. There's three books. They're all at Gardner's. You sell those. All I ask is when you sell them, just use some of that money to reorder the book. So I'm backing you to back me. And that's worked quite well with about 20 or 30 shops. Other shops, they say, oh, no, I only want to order from Gardeners. Well, they're at Gardeners. So I'm quite happy to give you some books to get you started. But like Scripthaven, I think you put me onto those, Rebecca, in Worcester. Lena Batchelor is doing an amazing job. She has lots of live events there all the time. I think she was voted, Scripthaven were voted number three independent bookshop by the Sunday Times supplement the other day.
Oh, excellent.
Warwick Books, Margot over at White, they are fantastic. They put on lots of events. So, as a Mary Hannah, who's a great writer, she said to me, she said, find a local bookshop you can work with and work with them. And that's what I've done. And I'm just trying to find lots more. Like I've got a couple of bookshops I work with in Hay on Wye. And I'm just finding my tribe and I'm trying to build up this little tribe. And I've got a nice tribe in the States of people that know me through the music world, through the Gold Coast Records. And they like the books because they're about the blues music industry, which they understand and they'll recognize different artists who I've kind of like used as a template for certain killers or members of the band. And so, you will find your tribe. You've just got to go and look for it. And I think you've got to forget about being the next Richard Osman because the world's changing. You may become the odd person, may become a Richard Osman, but the market is changing so quickly that I think the way forward now is to organically grow your brand. You've got to get out there. You've got to talk to people. You've got to blog. You've got to do shows like this with people who really care about books. That's one that comes across with talking to you and listening to the show as I do every week. You actually care about books. You're not in it to become millionaires. You're doing it because you love books and creativity. And that's where the future is. People who actually care about what we're doing. not people just trying to make a fast buck like the Spotify. They'll be gone at some stage in the future because they won't make any money. And the investors will suddenly realise, well, actually, you know, we've been investing in this for 15 years and made no money, but venture capitalists take all this money out of people's pension pots that they've never earned and just gamble it on the marketplace on things they don't understand. And then it's no consequence to them because it's not their money they've been gambling in the first place, is it? So,
yeah.
I'm having a bit of a rant here, aren't I?
No.
I think you've summed up very nicely.
It's be authentic, basically. Yeah. Isn't it? Just be authentic. Yourself.
Yeah.
If you've written a good book, and let's face it, I mean, I've read a lot of Hoback books, and you don't publish bad books. You make good books. All your writers.
We won't publish things we don't like. Exactly. We just won't. You know,
Brian Price and people like that, they're fantastic. But they're not bestsellers. But they've got a following, and you've just got to keep on growing that following. It's organic growth. That's the way forward. Keep on keeping on. It's the only way. That's for longevity. There's no shortcut to it.
That's a snowball.
Yeah, exactly. You've just got to keep going in life.
Just keep pushing the snowball, and it'll gradually...
And if you're doing stuff you believe in, it's easier to try hard, isn't it? If you're pushing something you're not that keen on, or if you're being a bit cynical about it, you're just doing it to make some money, then it's harder to stay committed, isn't it?
Mm.
But you have to be very selective about the people you take on.
Yes.
You can't say, I made the mistake, which I think you might have made a little bit, like, I signed all these people I believed in, I put out like 20 albums in the States in the first couple of years. Way too much. You can't support 20 albums properly. You just can't do it. But now I just pick a couple and get after those. So,
That's true, because we have slowed down and, we're generally closed for submissions because we know our limitations.
Yeah. Well, you have to. I mean, you're both very successful people in your own right. But I'm sure, like I've done, I've had to do other stuff to support my music.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, indeed. The freelance stuff.
Got to be done.
Well, let's now turn to arguably the most, let's put this, organic element in British podcasting, which, as we all know, is Rebecca's random question.
Okay, so I don't know if we need a sort of a PG warning on this one, but...
contains Nazis and nuns. No,
they contain
mild language or something. Anyway, so we were driving today to Cheshire, and Adrian is driving, and he calls somebody a Jabronian.
Jabroni.
Sorry, a Jabroni.
Yeah.
And I didn't say anything straight away, but then I said, "How do you know they're from Gibraltar?" And apparently, a Jabroni is just like a a rude word, like a cockwomble or something.
No, it's not as strong as that. I'm going to have to...
What does it mean, somebody from Gibraltar?
What the hell is a cockwomble? For God's sake.
Have you not heard that one?
I haven't heard that one, no.
Right, okay. Okay, a Jabroni in wrestling, which is where I get it from, is a jobber, which is a jobbing wrestler.
A jobbing wrestler?
Someone who's like,
amateur.
No, just someone who's a journeyman.
I don't know what that means either.
Who never is going to be a star.
Oh, just not very good.
Plods along.
Does this come from your Greek wrestling days in Cambridge, Adrian?
Well, okay, so the person who uses this word is The Rock when he's in wrestling mode.
Yeah.
But in reality, Jabroni, according to the Urban Dictionary, is a dumbass, a loser, a no-good son of a bitch, talks a lot of S, but can't back it up.
Okay.
So that's what a Jabroni is. It's not somebody from Gibraltar.
No.
Gibraltar, rather.
So we had this conversation. I understood that a Jabroni isn't a compliment. And I said, I'm glad you told me that, because if we go to Gibraltar and I say it's lovely to meet some Jabronis, I might get thumped.
Yeah. Can I just say, with this preamble, I still haven't got a clue what the question's.
No, you don't. No, I'm getting to it. There's lots of misunderstandings. Like, I thought a formica table was a thing.
Formica. Yeah.
I learned today that Tenderhook is not Tenderhook, it's Tenterhook.
Tenterhook, yeah.
So my question to you is there any sort of common phrase, word or phrase that you, most of your life you got wrong and then found out in adult life that you'd been wrong all along?
I think probably the word no. I've never fully understood it or recognised it.
that's your USP though, isn't it?
Yeah, if somebody says no, I always take that as a probably a yes.
Yeah.
Maybe a yes. Yeah, no. Thinking about that, no, not really. I put that down to my father and mother being very literary people, so I understood most things. I knew what tenacious was when I went to primary school.
Well, you're definitely that.
Yeah. I actually knew what the word was. But no, I've always thought that there's an answer you're given and there's an actual answer. And you have to take the answer you're given at the moment you're given it and then find a way to change it if it's not the answer you want.
Mm.
Unless it's pertaining to, can I kill your mother? Then you should take that at face value, I think. But
yeah, I think no in that case is
a lot of doors that were closed to me in business, I just approached those doors differently sometime later and got through them.
Mm.
I think that's the challenge of life, isn't it? There's always doors shutting in your face. And the successful people or the people that are happy either find a way not to go back to the door and still succeed or find a way to get through that door.
Yeah. But when there's a problem and you think, there must be a way. There must be a way. And then something clicks and you work it out and you think,
I'm afraid I'm a hopeless optimist.
Mm.
And I'm endlessly positive, which infuriates some of my friends who like to wallow in self-pity. but I'm just not like that.
Look at you. You like wallowing. Don't deny it.
I mean, I'm terrible, really. I mean, some of your legs fall off. So I'm hot then, you know. Just get on with it, you know.
I say that to him all the time. When he says, oh, I must be dying, I say, well, God, it's not that bad. Come on, you've still got today.
To be fair, Rebecca, you have no knowledge of man flu, do you?
Guy, you know, because we postponed this interview a day because I was
stricken.
I was on stage 4 stomach.
Yeah, you see, this is.
Yeah.
I said to him today, I said, I bet you thought you had stomach cancer yesterday, didn't you? I bet that thought went through your head.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing about the internet, isn't it? Never look up an illness. Never do that. It's the road to ruin, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Now I'm afraid I'm really old, so I'm really old school. I'm the basic. If I wake up any morning and open my eyes, that's a good start to the day. And then I'll just get on with it and find the most I can out of any day. I'm endlessly positive. Today I've been in Stratford writing again, and I always carry some cards with me because you may be amazed when you're sitting in a cafe writing. People, oh, what are you doing? I'm writing a novel. Who are you? What's it about? So I was, oh, that sounds good. I said, I've got a copy here. I'm an endless hawker, I'm afraid. It's terrible, isn't it? But that's just made for my coffee and sandwich.
I'm trying to think of a word that fits this.
Oh, well, but you're similar that you grew up in a very intellectual family.
Yes, but I'm thinking of sort of modern phrases which pass me by, and I'm trying to think of a few examples. But I mean, recently the language landscape has changed dramatically. And okay, here's one: mansplaining.
Oh yes,
mansplaining. I'm probably guilty of it the whole time, but I just think it's a word that shouldn't even exist. Is my feeling.
Well, I've never been guilty of that. You've met my wife, and I wouldn't last 5 minutes, would I?
No, she wouldn't let you mansplain.
I always think of Adrian as a swan slanderer.
A swan slanderer.
Yes, because you tell lies about swans, about Dom's swans, don't you?
Yeah, well, fat ducks,
well,
yeah.
Swans, yes, yes, for ducks, yeah. No, that's he true. Does. Don't believe anything he says.
No, that's perfect.
No, I don't.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it's a storytelling
thing. Yeah, you've got that storytelling thing. I love the idea of Americans going back. They say, did you know that all the dance have their own swans?
Mm. Yeah, getting into the a book.
You know, it's
urban legend. Urban
yeah, it's become a legend, and it will be studied at university one day.
But these are the but the nature of British history is that it is, you know, it's 50% fact and 50% folklore and BS, isn't it?
I mean, totally.
And that's the beauty of it.
Well, humans are natural storytellers. It's just the way we are.
Yeah, I was always a storyteller. In my life, in my business, I would walk into these boardrooms and I would tell them a story about how wonderful my company was and what we could do for them. And then I had to go away and try and make it true.
Yeah. It's like afterwards and you think, oh, shit, I've got to actually do it now.
That was a good story. I've got to make that happen. But that makes you work and improve, doesn't it? If you set that bar, you've got to get over that bar. So
yes.
And I set the bar for me. I've got to write a book every 6 months and it's got to be a decent book. So that gets me out of bed every morning.
So bring us up to date with progress with The Croaking Raven. When can people get hold of it?
Right, The Croaking Raven hardback edition is very exciting to have a hardback, is available from the 7th of March. It's available on pre-order at the moment on my website, which is info@guyhale.com, and many good independent bookshops as of next week. Mm-hmm. So, but if you love authors, come and buy it from the website because we make more money.
Yeah, buy direct.
Yeah, buy direct. It's the future. And you'll get a nice personalised message put on to you as well.
Oh, that's lovely.
And you can get entered for a competition to win the Jimmy Whiting trilogy as well. So,
okay. That's even good.
Yes. Incentives as well. Oh, yes. So, and then the paperback.
You know what you're doing and you're doing it well.
And the paperback comes out in May. So, and then I'm really looking forward to the Adrian Hobart edition of the the audio, my darlings.
Yeah, so, well, that's in my hands, isn't it? As to when that comes out, we shall keep you informed, dear listeners.
I know you're a busy man, Adrian. So no pressure. At least if it's a little bit in the distance, we can build up to it and create a theatrical glow as it approaches.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm so looking forward to getting stuck into some of those characters, particularly Wumper.
I really
want to hear your Wumper.
I'm really looking forward to saying to Adrian, when will it be available? It's tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Oh, very good.
On with Betty Case.
Well, Guy, good luck with it. And thank you again for joining us. And indeed, for working with us to, you know, it's been a pleasure.
I've really enjoyed speaking it through.
Well, I mean, you, especially Rebecca on this, when Adrian's part is about to start, but Rebecca has been so fantastic. I can't sing her praises highly enough. Such a clever, capable woman.
Thank you very much.
You work fast as well, Rebecca.
And I always do, because the thing is, if I don't reply straight away, I worry that it'll just get lost. So I do, I go bang.
there's no hanging around with you, Rebecca. And I couldn't have done what I'm trying to do here without your help. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you both down the pub soon for a bit of lunch and catching up with Adrian, bringing you your books and catching up with Adrian on how his voice development is going. So I'm sure it'll be spectacular.
Guy, as he says there, he wakes up, he's an optimist, wakes up every day and looking forward to what's going to come at any point.
Yes, he is an optimist, and me.
And since that interview, I've been trying to take the same approach, although it probably isn't very evident to you.
You have?
Well, I have a little. I have a little. You know, because I'm having some weird days at the moment with... basically, I've been taking a certain form of medication for a few years, and now my doctor's stopped me from taking it, and it's playing havoc with all sorts of sides of my personality and my well-being, as many people who've been on long-term medication and then come off it will know. So it's been a weird week, so I'm trying to stay positive.
Well, that's always a good thing. And I'm reading a book about emotional intelligence, so
I love it when you quote bits of me and then you tailor the words that you're working on to reflect my lifestyle.
Yeah, so it's a structural edit I'm doing for Summersdale, one of they're sort of psychology self-help books. I love it. Absolutely brilliant book again. And you're right, I do. I say, I change the wording. So that I'm doing the AI thing. I'm creating the...
You're personalising that book for me.
Yeah.
Normally to teach me a lesson about whatever else I've, I'm supposed to be
just done. To use your emotional but, intelligence, but, that's
but,
all.
But okay, look, I mean, I've been fairly... I mean, yesterday, we're recording this on the Sunday afternoons. We often do this podcast. I drove you over to Wakefield.
You did?
I was your chauffeur to a book
sort
launch.
Sort of, yes.
And again, it's another book that you've been working on.
Yes,
which was launched at
the Guide to
the Hepworth Museum in Wakefield.
Yeah, Research Communication. So this is my non-fiction freelancing head doing this. And we were invited to the launch and it was lovely, absolutely lovely. In the Hepworth Museum, so lovely atmosphere, great food.
Interesting people.
Lots of interest, very clever people.
Yeah, very, very, very clever people. Felt quite sort of inadequate. I mean, we did think we'll do a bit of West Yorkshire touring, but anyone who was in this neck of the woods yesterday will know the weather was absolutely abysmal. And, yeah, as I say, I just didn't have the energy to contemplate that with another 120-mile trip back south again.
We underestimated, didn't we, how long it takes to get there back? Because we actually got back at 5 o'clock, and that's without doing anything except the launch.
Yes.
So
yeah, I mean, you know, any thoughts of going to the Waterstones in Bradford, to the Parsonage at Haworth, as we discussed it.
And Tony's Brewery we were going to visit.
Yeah, we're going to visit the Saltair Brewery. Didn't manage that either. So, yeah, and sorry about all of that.
But we did go to 2 service stations.
Oh, marvellous. Yes, we did indeed. We ought to mention who our guest is next week.
We ought to. We've
again,
got
it's another returnee.
It is a yes,
sort of
returnee, and it's quite a special guest, I think.
Well, I mean, he is in the top 10 best-selling authors in this country at the moment.
Yeah, no, he's and we've been meaning to talk to him for a while, but things have got in the way. He was unwell. I had a invite to the IPG conference on the day we were supposed to talk to him.
So finally,
so it's like the fourth attempt, but
yes, JD Kirk will be joining us. And, you know, brilliant crime writer, lives in the north of Scotland and all around good egg. Really, really
lovely guy.
Lovely guy. Fascinating story, moving from being a sort of comic book specialist into and he was talking about setting up a romance series. So that's something else we can talk about, whether, you know, he and his wife have collaborated on that.
Yes.
And we talk about collaboration. Well, we were driving around. I mean, the one positive, really positive thing that came out of the drive through the dreadful weather yesterday was that we came up with an idea for a co-writing project.
I didn't think we were going to go public yet.
Oh, well, I'm not going to say any more than that, but we just came up with, you know, you said, well, when are you going to start writing again? And I said, and then we came up with an absolutely, well, we were just smitten with the world that we managed to build in a couple of hours in the car.
It is quite incredible, actually, because we've got the main characters, we've got some subsidiary characters. We know what they look like. We know their backstory. We know the world that they inhabit.
Inhabit.
Oh, is it not inhibit?
No, inhabit.
Oh.
Inhibit is to stop something from happening.
Oh, whoops.
No, they inhabit somewhere.
Oh, sorry.
We did a lot of world building and, you know, who knows where
we haven't got the plot yet.
And then I had another idea on the way back, which, again, we won't go public with, but it will be a departure. It will be the two of us, if we did it, performing and doing stuff. But, yeah, we're just blathering on. But the main thing we wanted to talk about on this day particularly is the fact it is your son Josh's 18th birthday.
It is. 18 years ago to this day, I almost gave birth in a car park.
Not in a service station.
No. No, hospital car park.
Well, happy birthday to Josh. And out of everybody, you know, all of the five boys that between us we have, he is the bookworm.
Oh, he is. In fact, I gave him 9 books for his birthday today. He's designed at least one Hoberg cover. He's done some other design work for Hoberg. He will, if he would like to inherit the empire, he's the most likely candidate, isn't he?
I would say so. I would say so.
If we were an episode of Dynasty.
If there was indeed an empire to inherit, he would be.
Or is it more like Crossroads?
It's not like, or Succession, you know, all five siblings fighting over the rights.
Well, they all have a role, because I think Luke would be the accountant. Mm. Ho would be the sales, perhaps. He could do sales.
James, let's not refer to his nicknames.
Why? Okay.
Well, he doesn't want to be. Well, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, okay. Ben could do marketing.
Yes. Well, who knows?
Toby could do the tech.
Toby, yes. Yes. If he could remember where he's left his tech. But anyway, he's 14. His organisational mind has gone to mush recently. It's been quite something. How many times have we had to sort of do emergency runs with gear?
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway. So, J.D. Kirk, our guest next week. And as far as this week goes, it's getting really, really busy in March. This week is sort of a preparatory week, if you like, for the week after, when we will be heading to Dorset as part of the Sharabang of Ackroyd Publishing, run by Rachel McLean, down to Dorset, where she has based her most successful series of books, and she's doing a public event. I'm doing the tech for that and all that sort of thing. But also it's a chance for us all to meet as an organisation, because she's put it together, added some people in the last 6 months, and now it's quite a big team.
Yeah.
And so we're all going to Dorset. I mean, it's like not quite five. I think it's about seven go to Dorset or something, isn't it?
Yes. What adventures can we have?
Yes, indeed.
Let's go and find some smugglers in caves.
Mm. And we continue to work extremely hard with our wonderful Hoback authors and our author team. And we have some great books coming up, and we have had some recent releases, which are wonderful. But of course, we have many other books that we've released over the years now, which we highly recommend. And if you want to find out the details of them and all the authors and everything about it, go to our website, www.hoback.net, for more details of everything that we do. And, you know, it's probably high time we did a blog. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, which you're going to be writing a little bit later with some...
I've already written it. I haven't sent it yet, but I've written it.
It's coming out shortly. And indeed, continue to please enjoy the Hobcast Book Show. We're enormously grateful for your company every week. We don't take it for granted, and we would love you to subscribe to the podcast and become regulars.
Do you know, I'm covered in a fine layer of sugar.
You are, because you have made a strawberry and chocolate cake.
It's coming off my skin. I don't know how that happened. Yes, I made a cake today. But anyway, we should finish. Sorry.
Yeah, we should.
Interrupting.
Yeah, I was just wrapping it up. But anyway, we wish you a wonderful and...
creative...
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hoback.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.